You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Dambisa Moyo is an international economist who comments on the macroeconomy and global affairs. And in 2009, she was named by Time Magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. That's really carrying a lot. That's very important to be known as that. And was nominated to the World Economic Forum's Young Global Leaders Forum. Her writing regularly appears in economic and finance-related publications such as the Financial Times, The Economist, and The Wall Street Journal. She completed a PhD in economics at Oxford, holds a master's from Harvard. In addition, she has an undergraduate degree in chemistry and an MBA in finance from American University in Washington, D.C. She is not, as I'm sure most of you here know, afraid of voicing controversial ideas. In her book, Dead Aid, Why Aid is Not Working and How There is a Better Way for Africa, she argued that most Western government aid programs have not only failed in Africa, but make things worse. Her new book, How the West Was Lost, 50 Years of Economic Folly and the Stark Choices Ahead, she takes on, among other things, the so-called American dream of home ownership. Hamish Ray, in Britain's newspaper The Independent, wrote, "The sad saga of the recession gives legs to Dambisa Moyo's provocatively entitled book, for it goes to the heart of the great economic issue of our times. How swiftly will power shift over this century?" Please join me in welcoming Dambisa Moyo to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening, and thank you very much. I really appreciate everyone being here this evening. I should start by saying I'm always a bit wary of these titles, and something happened to me quite recently which I thought was quite funny. I arrived at New York's JFK on a very late flight. I was exhausted, and I'm getting up to immigration, and the officer says to me, "What is it exactly you do?" And at this point, I'm really fed up, not in the mood, and I said, I'm an economist, and she says to me, "You're a communist?" And I say to her with indignation, "No, I'm an economist." And she said, "Well, I wouldn't be so sort of strident about being an economist. It's not like you guys were able to predict the financial crisis or anything." So I stand here before you as a communist today. No, I'm just joking. But anyway, I'm delighted to be back here. I lived here many, many years ago, actually, as a child. My father was at UCLA. And it's been wonderful to be back in Los Angeles, but also to do a mini tour of California. In some sense, bittersweet, because I was in San Francisco last week. I went up to Seattle, which I know is not California, but went to Seattle. Was in Santa Barbara, now in Los Angeles. And, you know, hearing just a moment ago that the library, this library actually is closed 2 days of the week, is some of the stuff that I guess we'll come to. But I find that really shocking and quite depressing. And also, you know, I was driven from Santa Barbara to Los Angeles, and I was really astounded at the infrastructure and how dilapidated it was. And, you know, so these are some of the things we'll be talking about this evening. But, you know, it's a great pleasure anyway to be back in Los Angeles, and I only wish I could have stayed a bit longer so I could have attended the Oscars or something exciting like that. But maybe next time. So I want to start off by talking a little bit about why it is I wrote this book, because my parents in particular were quite surprised. They said, "Well, you've done this book on Africa. What has that got to do with this new book, How the West Was Lost, and talking about some of the global and economic imbalances that we face today?" And actually, they're very, very related. And they're related because they're both about unintended consequences, good intentions that yield bad outcomes. And obviously, in the case of Dead Aid, my first book, it was talking about the idea of giving aid to Africa. We see Africa and we feel bad and we feel like we need to do something about disease, about poverty. But actually, sending money to Africa, as I argued in that book, has been incredibly detrimental. And what I want to do this evening is to make a similar argument, and catalog for you how over the past 50 years, policies around the three key ingredients that drive economic growth, capital, labor, and productivity, have actually led to an economic decline that we're seeing in the United States and across Europe today. So I should say, it's one of the things I find quite fascinating now whenever I open up newspapers or switch on the television is almost this crazed obsession with China. What's going on in China? China's got money, China's got strategy, China's got all this stuff. And it occurred to me that you can actually get obsessed with somebody else or another country or another entity, another team, actually to your detriment. And I guess the good analogy of this, since the Super Bowl just happened a few weeks ago, is sort of being the Green Bay Packers. And rather than focusing on your own weaknesses as a team, you get so obsessed with the teams coming beneath you, snapping at your heels, that you actually get relegated or you lose your top spot. And it's got nothing to do with the fact that these teams are better than you. It's just that you stop focusing on your own weaknesses. And in very much the same vein, I fear that the United States and European countries also are in this sort of strange situation where they're so obsessed with what China is doing, and actually a lot of the problems that are driving the decline of the United States economically relative to other countries has got nothing to do with those countries. It absolutely has to do with domestic policies and issues that are going on right here at home. So let's talk a little bit about what those things are and talk a little bit about why it is we're not, and by the way, I should say, by the end of this, you'll be nodding and saying, oh yeah, we already know this. What is she talking about? We already know about pensions. We know about infrastructure and so on. But we then have to ask ourselves, why is it that if we all know that these are the problems, why are we not able to solve the problems? So as I said, economists look at the world essentially in using three key ingredients that drive economic growth. The first one is capital, which is basically money. The second one is labor, which is basically the workforce, which is quite interesting given what's going on in Wisconsin and Ohio and so on. And then the third one is what we call productivity, total factor productivity. And actually in practice, and I'm sure economists in the room will know, it's a bit of a cheat, this productivity thing, because it's kind of like everything that we can't explain we throw into this productivity bucket. And the interesting thing about the productivity element is that it accounts for 60% for why some countries grow and other countries don't. And we'll talk a little bit more about this in a moment, but for now, just bear with me that these are the three key ingredients that economists focus on. So I want to start off by talking about capital and where we are. And as I go through these three elements, I really want you to think about not just the quantity of capital or quantity of labor or productivity, but also the quality associated with these factors. So when you speak about capital, how much money you have, I mean, it's quite apropos to be having this discussion in California, because in many ways, California, as we know, is a bellwether for the United States. And unfortunately, things like deficits and debts are very familiar here, but also are very much a hallmark of the United States economy today. It is characterized not just at the government level, but also at the individual level by high debts and very, very wide gaping deficits. And we really do know where this has come from. I mean, a lot of the issues have come from the subprime crisis, but it's not just that debt itself is a bad thing. In fact, there are lots of compelling arguments why debt can actually help fuel an economy. The problem is that the United States government and individuals have engaged in acquiring debt not for investment. It's actually, a lot of it has been used for consumption. And we can talk a little bit more about this as we get into Q&A, but essentially what you have is the United States, as again people in this room will know, now grappling with debt ceilings we're going to be debating shortly to increase those ceilings, but also with deficits that are effectively unsustainable, not just at the state level, but also at the federal level. If you compare the United States to, for example, China, China's situation is quite different. Not only does she have about $3 trillion in assets, in reserves, but also the way in which the money is being held is quite different. And what do I mean by that? Whereas in China, the government is very, very centralized and the money is actually pooled at a lot of the government entities. In the United States, although the United States remains the largest economy in the world, leading economies, about $4 trillion economy every year, GDP-wise, a lot of the money in the United States is quite diffused amongst pension funds and hedge funds and wealthy individuals. And the reason why this is important is that during times of strategic concerns, things like the financial crisis, or if there are issues around resources, buying up resources around the world, such as energy or land or water and so on, the Chinese government has much more flexibility in dealing with these issues than the US government. And this is just a structural issue, but ultimately, in terms of capital and getting out of a situation of high debts and wide deficits, it's quite important to understand that the U.S. in many ways is quite handicapped because the government itself is not able to embark on these big programs with sort of a pooled amount of money. Later on, if people wish, we can go through the numbers, but I think for now it's pretty clear that the U.S. government in particular, but also individuals, as I said, are sitting on way too much debt that has been backed by consumption as opposed to GDP-enhancing or growth-enhancing investments, which, in fact, if that were the case, I wouldn't have even been concerned about it because we would hope that the monies earned from the investments would be able to pay for interest payments. But the concern now is that you've consumed all this money and actually it's not been backed by any investments. It's been backed by consumption. And as interest rates start to rise, which they are in the 10-year sector and in the 30-year sector, there's a real risk that the U.S. Will be under immense pressure, not only to repay, but also to struggle to refinance itself. The second issue, which again, I imagine nobody will be surprised about here, is the issue of labor. And labor, the labor issues in the United States and across much of the West are numerous. It's everything from pensions, which we know is about the front page these days, healthcare costs, but also education. And let me quickly go through these three things. With respect to pensions, in the first case, even at this stage, we simply do not have a clear picture as to how much the U.S. government at the federal level actually owes. There are lots of numbers being bandied around. Some people say it's about $3 trillion, but we simply do not have an accurate picture of what the total liabilities that are owed to individuals through the pension, Social Security programs in particular. Now, we do know that whole industries like the auto industry, the airline industry, the steel industry have gone under, have had filed bankruptcy and had serious problems as they have grappled with issues around pension funds. But even as we stand today, the only thing that we know is that there's a looming problem that is not really being addressed. We're not certain about how big these liabilities are, but what is clear is that in effect, we're facing what I would in the book call the next big and largest Ponzi scheme. The whole essence of the public pension schemes has rested on the idea that the last in, the young people behind, were always going to pay for the older people, the first people who got in. But clearly, given the path of demographics as we know it right now, that's an unsustainable proposition. So, again, we have this theme of good intentions and bad outcomes because what we do know is that the government did implement pension funds with the hope of protecting people as they got older, but now we have a bad outcome because it's clearly unsustainable as we stand today. However, not much, apart from knowing that there's a big looming problem, is being actually done. And I think there are lots of proposals that we should be considering. In Europe, they're much further along in terms of the problem and distress, places like Greece and Ireland, where things like increasing the working age, but also capping accruals. I mean, these are the kind of uncomfortable truths that we have to address. And the reality around the pensions and other entitlements is that they have distorted the true price of labor in the United States, and in many ways have meant that American labor, as we know, is relatively uncompetitive when compared, particularly in the manufacturing sector, when compared to the international community. But it's not just pensions, it's also healthcare. And the fact of the matter is that when you look at healthcare costs going forward, what we do know, again, looking at some of the demographics, is that over the next couple of decades, the number of people 65 years or older is going to increase by about 250%. And this is really important because a lot of the diseases associated with Alzheimer's, with type 2 diabetes, and so on, long-term illnesses, are actually will really significantly affect the bottom line at the federal and at the state level. Already in the United Kingdom, in Britain, where there is a national health service, 75% of healthcare costs today are associated with long-term illnesses for the elderly. And this is something that's already on the rise. If you add on issues around obesity, and if you add on other concerns, like, as I said, like Alzheimer's, the costs amounting quite significantly. McKinsey, the consulting firm, put out a report not too long ago estimating that in the United States in the next several decades will have a healthcare bill to GDP of 100%. In other words, all the money that the country is making will go directly to healthcare. Now, obviously, something's going to have to give because that's obviously not something that's sustainable. So the question then becomes, what are we doing today to make sure that in the years to come, we can avert a crisis and actually put in place policies that can really make sure that we don't have a big problem with regards to healthcare? And it seems to me that not much is actually being done apart from giving this a lot of lip service. The third thing in the context of labor, which I actually, as we talked about earlier, the fact that the library here is only is closed 2 days a week, I think is really emblematic of a problem, of this problem, is the fact that the United States and many European countries are seeing their education standards slip significantly. And as somebody who was born and raised in Africa, in a context where people always talked about girls' education and the importance of education in general, it seems to me baffling that here we are in the United States in just one generation has gone from the first country in college grads to number 12. But moreover, if you look at the performance in education around mathematics, sciences, and even in reading, the United States has slid significantly. And I would urge you to have a look at the OECD report, which is the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. They've got a report called the PISA report. The U.S. is a member of OECD. And there's another report called the Trends in Maths and Sciences Study, and both of these are in my book. But if you look at the way American performance in mathematics and sciences, it makes very, very disturbing reading. I will also point out that these numbers are at the aggregate number, at the aggregate level. If you actually strip out some of the statistics and start looking at the disaggregated numbers, so in particular the performance of the minorities that are going to be the majority in the United States by 2042, the numbers are even worse. And you have to ask yourself, how is it then the United States going to compete against these emerging economies that are now in the top 20, way ahead of the United States and places like Britain in maths and science? A simple rule of thumb that many economists use when they're talking about economic development is that countries that are focused on agriculture at the bottom have very low incomes. And as you move into manufacturing, your incomes get higher. And from manufacturing, you move into services, your incomes get higher yet. And then the countries that have the highest levels of incomes are the ones that have moved from services into R&D, innovation, and technology. The fact of the matter is that the United States today does continue to be the leader in the world in technology, but the problem is that without investment in mathematics and sciences and even just basic reading, you simply are going to be uncompetitive and cede that position. So the question also becomes in this case, what is it that the United States is offering to the rest of the world that the world would be willing to pay a premium for? clearly as the emerging world is now able to produce manufactured goods and compete in stem cell research, in the production of computers and clothing, retail, you have to say the only thing that the world is going to be willing to pay the U.S. for are the most cutting-edge and innovative products. But at the same time, the world desperately needs the United States to get it right, because some of the biggest and most intractable problems that the world will be facing as we move into 2050, when there will be 9 billion people on the planet, absolutely require the U.S. to be involved and leading the technological charge. Things like the lack of water, issues around the lack of arable land, concerns about energy continue to loom to such an extent that if we don't have these things solved, and the only way we're going to solve them is really through innovation and technology, if these things are not solved, we will end up in much more conflict around the world. Moving away from labor, and I should just point out in labor, clearly the competitive edge is not just in that places like China and India are investing in education substantially, but also they have a wall of people who are constantly coming online to produce the same goods, now at the same quality for a fraction of the cost. But the third issue that I mentioned earlier as a key ingredient of economic growth is this idea of productivity. And I mentioned to you that it accounts for about 60% of why it is some countries grow and others do not. Now, this thing is kind of a catch-all for things as like rule of law, transparency, but importantly, it also is really emblematic of this idea of technology. And it's pretty clear now, looking back on the U.S. performance versus China and other emerging economies, that the United States has ceded and given away a lot of its technology for free. Sometimes it's been stolen, for sure, but on many occasions, American plants have been moved to emerging markets, and therefore you've had economies of scale sprout up in these other economies, and you've had a lot of the technology just simply transferred. But I want to just spend a little bit of time talking about this issue of productivity and how it is that the U.S., through, again, good intentions, has actually ended up with bad outcomes. Let me just take you back to the period of the 1950s to the 1980s. During this time, the United States was essentially closed to trade, to capital markets and capital movements, and quite disconnected or isolated from the rest of the world. And it wasn't just the United States. Most of the world was actually not very integrated. As we moved into the 1980s into where we are today, the world became much more integrated. And at that time, one of the biggest selling points for this idea that the world should become more integrated in terms of trade and capital movements and so on, one of the key stories that was being pitched by politicians was that Westerners in particular would see their incomes rise. And the idea was very rational. They said there'd be bigger markets out there. So Americans who are producing cars and computers and T-shirts and so on could sell multiples of what they were making into China, into India, and so on. And so it made sense. So between 1980 to today, what have we actually seen in practice? We've actually seen real wages be flat, not just in the United States, but across Europe. And we have to ask the question as economists, but also as individuals, what happened? Why did the promise of income rising not actually materialize in practice? And here actually is the rub. The fact of the matter is that through policies like the Housing for All policy, people in the United States took their incomes and invested in the housing sector. Now remember that the policy of keeping interest rates low, coupled with the idea of guarantees and subsidies, actually made housing look artificially attractive. So people took their money, but they also borrowed a lot of money, and they put it into housing. And, of course, the trade worked for some time, but we also know that subsequently we've faced the subprime crisis. But while Americans were taking their hard-earned money and putting it into the housing sector, they missed out on the boom in the emerging markets. So a lot of people did not invest in China or in India or in Brazil, and therefore missed out on that trade. And what has been the net position? Americans have had widening income levels, income inequality. You've had much more debt at the household level. You've had people miss out on this globalization trade, but also real wages have been flat. To me, I think it's absolutely wrong for policymakers to get involved, to alter, to manipulate, or to encourage us as households or individuals to take our money and put it into one asset class versus another asset class. I'm all in favor of housing for all, but it should be a choice that individuals ultimately make as part of a portfolio. Why should the government tell us or encourage us to put money into housing as opposed to bonds or stocks or commodities or cash? That is not the business of government. And although government does have a responsibility to try and get everybody to have shelter, it's a very dangerous game to play when you start to alter the housing market as the case has occurred. So through this catalog of policies of the Housing for All, which was not a Democratic or a Democrat versus Republican thing, both camps instituted these policies over time. But what we've ended up with is a situation where people have actually not benefited as much as they could have. We know also that through productivity gains, the emerging markets have become incredibly competitive, and it's them who have seen the real wages increase over time. So where are we today? We have widening income inequality in the United States because the people who hold capital have absolutely gained from the globalization trade. They put their money into stocks and so on outside of the US. But we've seen income widening because the people who had owned labor actually put their money into housing, and we know the story there. But we also know that 30 million, maybe as many as 50 million Americans are now out of work in the manufacturing sector and simply not competitive on a global basis. Now that I've depressed you enough, I want to tell you how I see the two options, what I call in the book America's Hobson's Choice. The United States can continue to be open to trade movements, to capital movements, and I have to say I would prefer that. I do think that if the policies are well implemented, it's important for the United States to remain part of the international community, not just in the short term, but also in terms of longer-term prospects of solving the big problems that the world continues to face: environmental concerns, climate change, poverty, and as I said to you, with 9 billion people expected on the earth in 2050, not too far away from now, we really need innovation and technology to help solve those problems, and the U.S. is absolutely in the lead of that. But what is the problem with the United States staying open? And by the way, clearly the U.S. government has decided that staying open is the way to solve, to stay engaged in the game. They are doing things in education. The 3% of GDP pledge by the Obama administration for science and technology is an example, as is the $45 billion plus investment in the Reinvestment Act for infrastructure. And of course, the Carnegie Mellon speech last year by President Obama around energy efficiency is just another example of the things that structurally, the pledges that structurally the administration is claiming is going to do. So what's the problem? Sounds like a good idea. They're working on it. But the problem with staying open and trying to solve these problems of infrastructure, education, energy efficiency in the United States are twofold. Number one, the pledges that we have on the table right now are simply not big enough. They are too small to actually have a meaningful impact given how bad things are. On this point, I think it's absolutely unfair that the United States continues to underwrite the vast majority of global goods, things like military, things like underwriting the sea lanes around the world without the support and help of other nations. And I think it's at the expense of healthcare, education, infrastructure, really solving some of the big problems that the US faces at home. But there's another problem with staying open, and that is nobody really plays fair. And I know that you've heard a lot about China playing with its exchange rate, not playing fair, but unfortunately, the US also doesn't play fair. And as someone who comes from Africa, I'm particularly sensitive to the issues around the agriculture subsidy market. The United States continues to maintain the farm subsidy programs, which locks out African goods in the United States, but also the Europeans do a very similar thing through their common agriculture policy. So the fact of the matter is this whole idea of free trade in practice doesn't actually exist. So what does that mean? It means that the U.S. might have the only other option she has, given this big population of unemployed people who are not competitive in a global phase, is that she may have to become much more protectionist. Now, this is not an ideal situation, but the fact of the matter is that it's certainly on the table. And as I just said to you, the U.S. already engages in protectionism. So the leap from protectionism and agriculture subsidies towards more aggressive tariffs or import subsidies on China's goods, for example, to me, in my head, is not such a big jump. Now, I know the idea of protectionism is one of these things that people think is sort of fringe and crazy. It's only the crazies who support protectionism. But the fact of the matter is that as the U.S. continues to grapple with high unemployment, and by the way, I should say, this is really the first time the U.S. is facing structural unemployment. Long-term unemployment is very common around the world. In Spain and across Europe right now, unemployment rates are astronomical. In Spain, it's 20% unemployment. So the U.S. is really grappling with something that it has actually never had to deal with before. And for me, that suggests that everything is on the table. And obviously, if you read some of the surveys coming out in the U.S. now, one I saw quite recently, 30% of college graduates are actually now in favor of protectionist policies. But let me take a quick moment in concluding here to talk a little bit about what we've really been speaking about here, and this is the idea of incentives. And by that I mean we live in a world where incentives are absolutely essential and important in driving economic growth. In fact, I would say that the success of the United States over the past 300 years and across Europe has absolutely rooted in the idea of creating the right incentives for entrepreneurship, for inventors, and for business. In fact, places like China and India have cottoned on to this very point. They look at the United States and they look at Europe and they say, gosh, if we can create an environment where there's physical infrastructure, transparency, rule of law, we can create an environment of incentives that will encourage people to do the right thing. The problem with the situation in the United States today with regards to incentives is that policymakers are incentivized to focus on the short-term tactical issues such as deficits and unemployment, which are very important, and not focus on the longer-term structural problems such as education, healthcare, infrastructure, pensions, and so on, energy concerns. And the fact of the matter is that we are to blame, because although we are caught in this and trapped in this cycle of hyper elections every 2 years. We've just come from an election in November 2010. We've got elections again next year in the United States, 2012. The fact that we're caught in this trap of hyper elections actually means that our governments are very rationally focusing on short-term issues in order to win votes. And it is that exact thing which is causing the detrimental situation that the U.S. is in today. I am not proposing that we get rid of democracy, which some people would love to say I am. I am not saying that in order to focus on the long term, you necessarily have to have a non-democratic government. What I am saying is that the US, in order to really get policymakers incentivized to focus on structural issues as well as the short-term tactical issues, we've got to start to reward them for not being myopic. And the manner in which you could do that could be everything from taking a leaf out of what's going on in Mexico, where the president has one term, but it's a much longer term. Or it could be actually, in a very micro sense, we might have to go get back to basics and incentivize people to do the right thing. Let me give you a quick example. In Mexico and in Brazil, and actually Mayor Bloomberg in New York is trying out, has got some trials on this now, using his own money, there's this idea of conditional transfers. So you start to pay people to do the right thing. You want to, your child goes to school, has got a great attendance rate of 98%, you get paid $100. Your child gets immunized for a particular disease, you get paid $100. This is not ideal, but in terms of incentivizing people to send their kids to do mathematics or to go to school even, it might have to be the case that we have to start incentivizing people to do the right thing. Ladies and gentlemen, the fact of the matter is we all know what these problems are, but unfortunately we're simply not focused on solving these problems. The United States and European countries have to make a decision about the trade-off between focusing on salvation and saving themselves today versus sacrificing today in the interest of keeping America going as a long-term economic growing concern. And that is a very tough choice. There are sacrifices that need to be made, but the reality is we know for sure that China is going to keep growing. We know that China is going to keep growing faster than the United States. What we don't know is if China can actually converge the per capita levels of income that the United States is at today. And it's really up to the United States and individuals like yourselves to make sure that the world actually continues to solve the big intractable problems that we're facing. And the only way you can do that is by making sure that your policymakers are not at each other's throats, but actually focusing on these structural problems. I thank you very much for your time, and I very much look forward to your questions. Ah, okay. I think there are two microphones, if I'm not mistaken.
I got the microphone. I guess I got the question.
There's an idea that gets kicked around now and then. Buffett sometimes stumps for it, and Russ Feingold introduced it to the Senate one time. And the idea is one of import certificates, and we're trying to control the trade deficit here without going into trade wars. Mm-hmm. And if a guy, say, exports $1 million worth of goods, he then gets an import certificate for $1 million, maybe $1.1 million, and he can sell that on the open market, but if you want to export something, you have to have one of those certificates. And it's kind of an in-between your choices of keeping things free and open and getting protectionists. Has this proposition been analyzed in sober ways by professional economists and things?
There's no such thing as sober in economics. it's a very good proposition. I've heard about it. I haven't seen it properly analyzed. I have to say that anything that smacks of layers of additional bureaucracy, I tend to shy away from. But frankly, I think that we should consider everything. Aside from Warren Buffett, as you say, I haven't really heard it discussed, even at the international community level, sort of at the World Bank or IMF, who know very much about are concerned about these trade balance matters. But conceptually, it seems to make sense to me, given where the U.S. is today. But I don't think there's much more work than what I've heard from Warren Buffett. That I certainly haven't seen it.
I'm a little curious about your analysis of the problems in the States, which you attribute to the politicians being incentivized for the short term. I quite agree with you on that point, but I'd like you to comment on the position in Europe, where there are much longer term in terms of their being in power and so forth, not the same cycle of elections. But they seem, from what you say, to be having similar problems.
Yeah, I think the problems around the hyper-politicization, as I've called it, have become much more manifested when trying to solve issues. Clearly, in the context of a lot of the European countries, you do have longer-term cycles in principle, but actually you have a lot of turnover in the interim. So, for example, in Britain, for example, you have a five-year prime ministerial period, but actually you're constantly having these by-elections, and you have a lot of turnover between the 5 years. So it would be the analogous to having senatorial elections or the midterms. I would argue that in the context of Europe, you still have the long-term problems around pensions. Europe, as many people might be aware of, in 2010, for the first time, started a decline in its population. They've got a lot of issues around immigration, huge problems around pensions, infrastructure, all the big things that we're talking about here, and also education declines. But the difference is there. I would say that in comparison to the United States, although the cycles look like they're longer, you still have an issue of the governments being focused on relatively short-term issues as the way that they win elections. They don't win because of education or infrastructure. They win because of deficits. Prime Minister Cameron in the United Kingdom is a very good example of this. So I think just to summarize what I'm trying to say, I think that the issues of hyper politicization becomes a bigger problem when solving these problems as opposed to when the problem has actually emerged, if that makes sense. So something like demographics has emerged in both of these regions, but in terms of how you actually get ahead around to solving it, I think that it becomes much, much more obvious in the United States than it is in perhaps in Europe, because we've got shorter cycles.
You touched briefly on the problem with the short-term outlook for our elected officials based on the election cycle. But to what extent does the financing system of elections in this country, especially exacerbated by the recent Citizens United Supreme Court case, essentially move us towards an oligarchy where the well-heeled moneyed interests of both industry and individuals can really start to sway people where they are not so concerned about perhaps the voters' needs, but about the financiers' needs?
So this is a great question, because I think you have to answer it. To me, I don't quite understand how lobbying, the whole lobbying industry is not just, I think this is what you're touching on, the whole lobbying industry is not just good old-fashioned bribing. Where I come from, that's what we call it. But, I mean, here, it's kind of been dressed up into something else. I think it absolutely is an integral part of what you see in the United States. And I don't understand how the U.S., excuse me, U.S. society gets its head around having the FCC, the Foreign Corrupt Practices policy, which Carter put in place in 1977, how you have that, and then at the same time you have a whole industry where people are paid for representation. I simply don't answer. I don't understand it. So if you're asking me, do I think it influences policies? Absolutely. If you're asking me, do I think that there's something kind of that's, you know, something rotten in the state of Denmark, if you will. Yes, it seems to me particularly odd. But obviously, in the land of the free and the home of the brave, I would imagine that you guys have thought about this, and you must have come up, you know, got it around your heads that it's not bribery. But
this is a question a little bit off your topic, but since it's in an area of your expertise, I want to ask it anyway. I'm well aware of what Western Europe and the United States did to Africa in terms of creating nations that weren't geographically or culturally unified, and the slave trade and all that. And I feel remorseful about that and feel that we owe Africa quite a bit. And yet on the other hand, when you look at Africa today, you see these horrible wars, and for every Nelson Mandela, you seem to have a dozen Idi Amins and Muammar Gaddafis, and for the dollars that go there, probably 3 out of 4 end up in some Swiss bank account. And how does a reasonable person attack a problem like that, or think about a problem like that in Europe?
So, first of all, not that I'm God, but I want you to not feel another ounce of guilt anymore about the African continent. It's been 60 years from some countries since we've had independence. You know, as I outlined in my book, Dead Aid, you know, I don't know how long this guilt trade is supposed to last. I don't know if it's sort of after 150 years, people will no longer feel guilty. But, you know, you had your campaign, Move On America. My view is Move On Africa. I mean, at some point, you know, we've just got to take responsibility for what actually is going on across the continent. You're right that there's still significant concerns around despots and authoritarian leadership, not just in Africa, but across many other places in the world. And I think what's happening in the Middle East and North Africa now is really symptomatic of economic concerns. And I think you likely see those types of knock-on effects in other places in Africa, precisely because people are kind of fed up and they want to have economic growth and reductions in poverty. In terms of what it is the U.S. citizens or what the U.S. should be doing, I think I would just say, you know, play fair. You know, you cannot, on the one hand, claim to be the beacon of democracy, truth, light, and fairness, and on the other hand, hand out billions of dollars to these despots and expect the average African on the ground to be able to hold their governments accountable. I think it's absolutely wrong that you maintain diplomatic ties with the big despots, known despots, the people that the media criticizes, whether it's Mugabe or Gaddafi or whoever. You cannot hold these guys to a higher standard if you're absolutely engaged with them in policy. And this goes to the core of the American value system. You know, ultimately, what do you care more about? Do you care about the people on the streets in these countries that are suffering, or do you care about having more oil? And it seems to me that the choice is in policy, in practice, has been that you prefer to have more oil, and there obviously is a penalty and a cost to the rest of the world.
My question goes to a simple economic question.
Sorry, there you are. Thank
yes.
you.
Back to basic economics. technology, scarcity and profit, and technology and unemployment. Doesn't innovation in technology create unemployment? Your backward bending labor supply curve. And then if you do have innovations in technology, the fact that we have a profit system and the need for scarcity to increase the price doesn't make it really available to our use and enjoyment or reinvestment in our educational systems, or to create the kind of incentives that people that really want to go into math, science, and engineering. Everything about education is about math, science, and engineering, but there are other things that really make life livable. Mm-hmm. And that's really where a lot of our issues are coming in. There's so much concentration on this math, science, and technology that creates unemployment that people aren't really enjoying their lives, saying, or finding those incentives to create the renaissance that we need economically, politically, et cetera, et cetera.
So, first of all, my disclaimer is that I'm not a mathematician or a scientist. I do have a science background, but it's totally by accident. I should never have been a scientist. And I say that not flippantly, but my point is simply, of course, we need other areas. But the problem in the United States is not that somehow you've got highly educated people coming out in droves in humanities and social sciences and not enough scientists. The fact of the matter is the education in its entirety actually is not doing well. I am not of the view that because you have improvements in technology, people are necessarily going to be out of work. I think there are other things that people can do that we simply aren't thinking about because we're so obsessed with them being in what I would consider jobs that sort of stuck in jobs that they don't necessarily need to do. So I'll give you an example, which somebody gave to me, somebody who is at MIT. He said he's at MIT, but he focuses on something called one laptop per child, which I think is quite interesting. We had a big discussion, similar discussion about this, and he said, "Look, there are a lot of jobs people don't want to do, cleaning toilets, for example. Now, if technology can come, if we can actually invent robots to clean toilets, and somebody doesn't have to clean toilets, isn't that a good thing for society?" And I'm actually quite sympathetic to that. Now, what might that person do instead? that's obviously something that we as society and that, or that individual will have to pick. But I don't think we should say, oh, technology is bad and it's taking away jobs, because I actually think there are a lot of jobs that people would rather not be doing, but they're actually forced to do because technology hasn't been fast enough in coming up. But you're right that in principle there is a lot of discussion about mathematics and innovation. And as I said to you earlier, the reason for that is because the world is happy to pay the United States a premium for innovation in the areas of technology and R&D, because that's the only thing that the rest of the world can't, at this point, produce for itself. Unfortunately, things like manufacturing, agriculture, and so on, they can produce, and they no longer need the United States to do that. Now, you could argue, and I do argue in the book, that the United States is in probably a stronger position than we think, because you do have a market here, a captive market. You don't necessarily need to sell your goods abroad. But that being said, and I hope this is not sounding contradictory, because I'm not trying to make it sound like that, but that being said, you do need technological advancement. Not, again, as I said earlier, not just for the United States itself, but we need technological advancement because of the big problems that we're going to be facing as we move into 2050.
Hi. Over here.
Thank you.
Hi. Getting back to a little bit of the politics, you've touched on it a couple of times tonight, and it's a question that I've always wondered about if it would ever be one that would come up during a presidential campaign. It's simply, when will the American people get tired of paying for their empire? And until such time as we deal with that issue, I think structurally nothing else is going to change.
So I think the way I hear your question, I think the way I phrased it or tried to phrase it earlier is in essence a similar question. And this is the idea, and let me just go back. In economics, there's this idea of Ricardian equivalence. And I won't bore you with the details of what Ricardian equivalence is, but one of the assumptions of Ricardian equivalence is that we care about our future generations. So in other words, we're intergenerationally linked. And in practice, Ricardian equivalence actually fails, and a lot of economists say it fails because in practice, people actually don't care about their future generations. They care about themselves. Listen, I know I had you as a child, but okay, you're on your own. Too bad. And I just want to say the reason I wrote my book is because I believe that people care. I think people care about America. Americans care about America. They care that America will continue to be a leader, not just economically, but also as a value system. And you know, I see people grimacing when and you know, cringing when they talk about things like these double standards of, you know, on the one hand you say you care about girls' rights, but at the other hand you're taking oil from Saudi Arabia, or, you know, on the one hand you care about issues of democracy, but on the other hand you're giving money to some of the most long-lived presidents in the world. But my point, coming back to this thing about paying for the empire, is that ultimately the question then becomes, is it true that Americans actually care about their future citizenry? In which case, I think they would say to themselves, I'm willing to make sacrifices today in the interest of America tomorrow. If they don't care, in which case they say, well, too bad for my kids. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that's actually the case. If that's the case, then policymaking would be quite different. And the point at which Americans get fed up for paying for their empire, as you put it, I think the question becomes quite different depending on which side you fall on. Because I believe and hope, maybe it's my own naivete, that Americans actually care about the future generations, I think they'll continue to be willing to pay, they will not be willing to pay for much longer for this sort of cutthroat, at each other's throats, politicians and politicking. I think if they don't care about future American generations, then they'll tolerate a lot of the stuff that's going on today. I'm sorry, I'm actually not responsible for the picking, so.
Hi. I have a historical question that I think deals with today as well. I've heard the argument that the 1920-21 depression really lasted a year, mainly because government and the Fed didn't get involved and try to control things, as opposed to the Great Depression, the one that we know, which started in with Hoover and all the way that and with Roosevelt. That Roosevelt actually made it worse by all of these government programs that he initiated, including the one that you were mentioning about controlling agriculture. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on that, that if more government control actually hampers the economy or kind of letting the different sectors play out on their own, is that better for the economy? What are your thoughts on that? And historically, if you have an opinion between those two different depressions.
Okay, so I don't have an opinion on the two comparative depressions, but I do have an opinion on the role of government. In general, I think that there's a lot to be said for letting the markets do their thing. However, in the context of the question, and in specific in the role of government intervention in the last round, which is basically into the financial markets, I strongly believe if the U.S. government had not stepped in, and not just the U.S., but a lot of governments around the world, if they had not stepped in, things would have been much, much worse than they actually turned out to be. And I know that's hard to believe because things have been so horrendous, but it would have been much worse. The reason why there's a case for government to step in the context of the banking sector versus, let's say, another sector, like the potato market, for example, is because the banking sector has systematic risks that have severe knock-on effects for the economy as wide. And I won't go into details. This is all in my book for people who will be interested in buying it, and I'm not trying to do a hard sell. But the point just being that many banks, even banks that were not involved in the financial crisis, for example, were not involved in the subprime lending, would have been affected through knock-on effects by other banks falling who had actually lent into the subprime crisis. So the governments had to step in, and Lehman was a classic example. The fact that Lehman went down, there were so many contracts throughout the banking sector that if the whole industry had collapsed, it would have been a serious problem, something completely unfathomable. So I do think there's a role for government. I'm not a big government person, but I do think at the same time, going back to what I said earlier, if the government had in the first place not got involved to try and make the policy or put in policies to make the housing sector look attractive, artificially attractive versus other asset classes, you probably wouldn't have ended up with a subprime crisis. So now that we are in, quoting McChrystal, you have to start from where you are, not where you would like to be. Given we were in the financial crisis, I think the government had to act in the dramatic way that it did. And, of course, it was very costly and very bitter.
Hi there. Over here.
Hi. Oh, sorry.
Hi. Let's see. You talked about the necessity of putting incentives in the economy and also sacrifices. Could you explain a little bit more in detail about how do we do both at the same time? And specifically, could you also address your views on tax policy?
So how do we do both? I mean, I think that, this goes into minutiae, but just to give an example, sacrifices, things like you might have to give up on accruals on your pension funds. So yes, maybe the government had agreed to pay you, conversation purposes, $1,000 extra a year. Well, maybe the government's going to have to say, sorry, we can't pay you that. Or you're going to have to go on furloughs, as which are very common now in California. How does that go off against with the incentives? Well, maybe the monies that are saved could be funneled towards providing monies towards people to encourage people to do sciences and mathematics, as we talked about earlier. I mean, that would be an example of how you do these offsets. But obviously, the devil is in the details, so to speak, and really how you actually balance out the incentives versus sacrifices, I think, is one of society. I mean, I think there are people who will say, and going back to this gentleman's question here, it really depends on how much today's generation of Americans who are older, who have invested in pensions and had expectations of pensions, are willing to sacrifice for the younger generation of Americans who aren't going to school or whose education standards are slipping. So it's a value judgment. With respect to tax policy, it's a tough one because, as some of the stuff that I've read, In the United States, something like 45% are not paying, 45% of people are not paying federal taxes already. And, you know, it's a very, very difficult thing because on the one hand, there's a lot to be said for taxing people at high incomes. I mean, I was astounded to hear about President Obama's visit to San Francisco last week. In fact, we went to San Francisco at the same time, but he had gone for dinner with some of the internet tycoons or whatever. What is it? I don't even know what the name is, billionaires or whatever the term is now. I think a handful of them together were worth something like $57 billion, which they were worth more than some countries. And this is in the same country where I was in Santa Barbara. And the, as I said, the roads were, I was shocked at how bad the roads were there. And, you know, you look at some of the statistics, people aren't even going to school in this country. Is that fair? That's not my value judgment. Should we be taxing those people more so that we can funnel the money towards things? That's a value judgment that Americans have to pick. I can, you know, suggest, sort of encourage people to, this is what they should do. This is ultimately a reflection of American society. But at the same time, the reason why it becomes difficult is because people then say, well, if you tax people too high, the world has become so flat, they can just pack up and move to another another country. And you do need them to create jobs. And that's those are the actual practical difficulties that policymakers face on a day-to-day basis. And that's what makes it very difficult.
You take as a given the doubling of the world population over the next 40 years, but you didn't mention anything about the production of food or fiber to take care of those people. Why is that?
So they didn't mention the production of food or?
Fiber.
Like, so I did mention resource scarcity. Today, about 1 billion people go hungry every day. There are a lot of structural issues that I think we should be addressing that we're not. And I'll give you a specific example. 1 billion people go hungry every day in the world. The majority, the highest proportion of people go hungry are in Africa. And it's anywhere between 300 to 500 million people that go hungry are in Africa. So the highest concentration is in Africa. But Africa is also the place that has the highest untilled arable land left on the planet, which is why China, South Korea, all rushing to buy African land. To me, as an economist, that is a structural problem. That you would have supply, you've got the land, but you've also got demand, you've got starving people. So this is a dislocation that suggests to me that's a structural problem. It's nothing else than that. However, if you start looking at sort of the discussion around food, it becomes highly politicized. In fact, Amartya Sen, the Nobel laureate, says there's no such thing as an apolitical food problem. And I think he's absolutely right, because we know, aside from the fact that Africans are not able to sell their goods into the U.S. and Europe, agriculture produce, except, you know, very small through AGOA, we also know that there are a lot of people who campaign that the land should not be tilled. There are lots of environmentalists who argue that these lands need to be preserved. And although I'm sympathetic to that, there's obviously a trade-off. At some point, you know, do we care about people surviving over the land, or do we care more about land and preservation over, you know, people's survival? I think issues of around food and water in particular, and also energy, are going to be the biggest problems that the world faces in the next few decades. And really, we are incredibly ill-prepared for these issues. I mean, the Chinese government is moving whole rivers, you know, redirecting rivers because of the issues around water. And we are just absolutely not prepared. I mean, already the world is consuming 85 million barrels of oil a day. The oil that we're consuming today is from oil finds from the 1950s and 1960s. In other words, since the 1960s, we've had no major oil finds on this planet. And the United States, with 300 million people, consumes the full production of the first two. Saudi Arabia and Russia are the biggest oil producers. Everything that they produce on a daily basis is consumed by the United States. The U.S. consumes about 20 to 25% of global oil production. Can we really imagine a situation where India or China have converged to the point of the United States' consumption? It's just impossible. it's just absolutely impossible. And I think issues around food are just going to be, as we already know, just go and look in how many conflicts there are around the world now associated with water or oil, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan. These are all essentially issues of minerals and oil and so on. And I think you'll see a lot more of that around the world as these emerging markets continue to rise.
Mbisa, that's our last question. I want to thank you so much for coming to talk to us tonight. We'll meet you in the lobby in a few seconds. Thank you so much. Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.